It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. President Trump says the U.S. will impose new tariffs on Mexican goods until that country stops the flow of illegal immigrants at the southern border. We'll dive into the details coming up. First, it's time for Food Friday. If you're anything like a lot of the Central Time staff, you probably have between a handful or more of cookbooks sitting on your bookshelf at home. You might also have some recipes bookmarked or printed off from various websites and go-to food blogs that you go to on a regular basis. So for this week's edition of Food Friday, we wanted to showcase some of our favorite recipe sources and learn about some of yours. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is there a favorite cookbook or one you might recommend to a new cook? Do you have a favorite website to go to, a favorite magazine? Give a call now. 800-642-1234. Judith Sears Poisson joins us, executive producer of Central Time and a big cooking fan herself. Judith.
It's true.
Hi. Haven't seen you in a while.
Yeah, I know. So minutes.
What are some of your favorite cookbooks? Do you use cookbooks religiously?
Well, okay. So I have a huge stock of cookbooks that I do or do not go through very often, but I like having them there because they often, there's often kind of a theme. Maybe it's a region of cooking or seasonal stuff. I really like cookbooks that are divided by seasons. Mm-hmm. And so if it's, you know, fall and I've got lots of great like root vegetables or something and I'm just getting tired of maybe just roasting them, I go there and look for things. So I like having them. I have to say I've switched to a lot of things online, but I really like having cookbooks.
Are there cookbooks that were big difference makers in your career as a home cook?
My career as a home cook. Well, going back to the early days, Rob, truthfully, one book that I still use, I got it when I was probably five. It's called The Cook-Along Book.
Wow.
And there's a picture of two little kids with little chef's hats on it and an adult in the back. And each recipe, They're geared towards kids, teaching them how to use knives properly. In the middle of a recipe, all of a sudden they'll say, have you washed your hands lately? Or make sure you get a parent to help you with this. And there's some really great basic recipes. I actually go there for the beef stew recipe.
Wow.
Anytime I do it. I also use other cookbooks. Like I love Julia Child again for kind of like the basics. But what she often does is gives you the really basic recipe and then variations on it. And so I really like that. The one thing I've learned about Julia, though, because of when she was writing it, she basically cooks every piece of meat to death. Mm-hmm. So you have to adjust for that. But yeah, I do really like cookbooks. I like reading cookbooks and looking at them.
And then do you have food websites or blogs or whatever that you like to go to?
Yeah, I go to some of the big ones like Epicurious. I actually find a lot of things on Epicurious. Cooking Light, I find a lot of the recipes are maybe a little simpler, fewer ingredients, and pretty healthy, but tasty. I will often look at the reviews and see what other chefs have said, cooks have said. It's kind of like any review site. You kind of get rid of the best and the worst and look at the middle ones. But I find that really useful. And because I've been trying to eat a little more low carb, I've been going to some that have more low carb cooking, and I like that.
Now, this may surprise you as someone who works with me. I have a very short attention span.
Really?
And yeah, can you believe it? What are we talking about? No, and so I tend not to go in and dig deep and find recipes and go through a cookbook with a fine tooth comb. But I'll find a technique in a recipe, and then I'll say, oh, what can I do with that? I don't have the patience a lot of times to stick with a long and complicated recipe. And then online, I'll just do a general web search. I'll look at five or six recipes, find out the one that sounds plausible and not too much of a pain, and then I'll go with that.
I'll say when I try a new recipe, I generally stick with it pretty closely the first time. But then if I often, you know, start doing variations on a theme and I'll, you know, switch up. I would say as a rule, I kind of, I double or even sometimes triple vegetables, like if it's in a mixed dish, because I find sometimes they're a little skimpy on the vegetables. I'm also a big spice person, so I often double or triple the spices and always lots of garlic.
We'll go to callers in just a second. Do you print off recipes online?
Not so much anymore, but I used to, and I have a couple binders actually that I've like stuck things in and, you know, things like that. And I'll go back to some of those as well.
Yeah, I've got a folder that's got a handful of ones that I know I'm going to do again and again.
Yeah.
A bread pudding recipe, the zucchini relish I've talked about probably 50 times in the show because this stuff, it's amazing. I've got a handful of now well-stained recipe pages.
You should see the cook-along book that I've been using since
I was
five.
I'm sure that's looking good too. We are looking for your favorite cookbooks, cooking magazines, cooking websites, or maybe you've got a family treasure trove of recipes to tell us about. Call 800-64 421234. We'll go to your calls now. Michelle is with us in Greenfield. Michelle, hi.
Hi. My favorite magazine, and I wait for it every month, is the Food Network magazine. It's got a picture index in the beginning that's really well organized, like appetizers, desserts, main courses. They also have like a couple of meals that are low calorie. They give great directions, and it's just an awesome magazine. I really, really love it. That index is just super handy in the beginning.
And is this aspirational, Michelle, or do you open it up and then over the next month or so cook a bunch of these recipes?
I do. I open it up and I mark recipes, and I used to save all the magazines, but oh my gosh, my house started to look like a hoarder house. So now I'm just ripping out the ones that for sure I'm going to use. It's a terrific magazine, and I'm looking forward to, I'm a teacher, I'm looking forward to summer and having time to really try some of these.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Michelle. We heard from some of our colleagues here at work. I think we had some people talking about magazines. Jill Nadeau from the Larry Mueller Show likes the Cook's Illustrated cookbooks, actually. They do great magazines, too. Mm-hmm. Do you have any magazines you've been into over the years, Judith?
You know, I used to get Cooking Light, but then it just got too much. I tend to look at magazines online instead. Okay. And then just, yeah, bookmark them.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Frank in Milwaukee. Frank, hi.
Hello there. How are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Frank?
I love the Flavor Bible. I can't tell you the author's name. It's a team. They've had a couple other really good books, too. Mm-hmm. What to Drink with What You Eat. And I can't think of their other title, but they're really, really good. Flavor Bible breaks down basically the science of taste and how certain foods work together. The thing I really like about the Flavor Bible is it lists just about any and every ingredient that you could think of, and then tells you like the characteristics of it, the density, the strength, the flavor, the seasonality, and then it lists what other pairings with that particular ingredient.
Right. So it isn't so much recipes, right, Frank? I like this approach. It's like, here's, if you want to wing it, great, but here's ways to wing it smart.
They do give some recipes as well, and the author's sources for this are, you know, great chefs around the country at, you know, James Beard Award winning chefs. So I guess I can trust them.
Frank, thank you so much. I appreciate it. The Flavor Bible. And I love ideas like that. And some of my favorite things I've gotten out of Food Friday conversations are, you know, those little tips. This flavor is going to bring out this. You know, a little vinegar at the end is going to bring out the flavor in the soup. That kind of tip I love.
Yeah. And I have to say, I have picked up a lot of techniques from actually going to cooking classes. And I know a lot of people watch cooking shows. And actually, I have quite a few printouts of recipes that I actually got to watch someone make. And so
that's cool.
So I have the sense of, you know, what to do and what not to do.
Let's go back to our calls. Thanks for that. Shane with us next in Eau Claire. Shane, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good.
Thanks for my call.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about, Shane?
Some of my favorite places to look, especially if I'm making something new, is maybe Alton Brown or the Frugal Gourmet. Mm-hmm. But I'd also like to say that, you know, if you're more on the lazy side of cooking, you know, you can buy a salsa, right, and doctor it to make it your own. You know, add more peppers, add more tomatoes, add onions, add a lime. Same thing with tomato sauces. The list goes on and on. And then besides that, you know, if you're new to cooking, something that I also would recommend is, you know, just cooking white rice and putting whatever seasoning you're interested in trying on it, just so you get a better sense of what that flavor is like and how you can use it for your own cuisine. You know, if it's going to be chili powder or cumin or, you know, more exotic things like turmeric, you know, that's a good way to kind of jump into how you can use them for your own as you get into cooking.
That's a great idea because you're kind of using the rice as a blank canvas and putting the ingredients. I have to say my mother was a very good cook. I mean, I really enjoyed her cooking and I miss her cooking. And as I got older, I realized that she actually was doing exactly what Shane was saying. She made amazing spaghetti sauce, but actually she started with the most basic ragu, but she added neck bones and she added more garlic and she added this and that and this and that. But yeah, she was starting with a ready-made ingredient.
Thanks so much for that call at 800-642-1234. Judith Sears-Poisson is here with me. We're talking about cookbooks, cooking magazines, cooking websites. We want to hear yours at 800-642-1233. What do you keep going back to? What do you think is great for new cooks or not so new cooks? We heard from Central Time producer Rachel Vasquez. We asked around here. She says, the holy grail for recipes in my house is and always will be my mom. You rock, mom. But Rachel says, outside of mom, I'm currently living out of Pam Anderson's updated How to Cook Without a Book and America's Test Kitchen's The New Essentials. Both are great workhorse cookbooks. A lot of basics you can tweak and customize. What's yours? Call 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation. Maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we continue our conversation about favorite cookbooks, food magazines, and food blogs with Central Time executive producer Judith Sears Poisson. And you can share your favorites at 800-642-1234. What is the cookbook you keep going back to, the website you keep referring to when you need that recipe for whatever you need to make? Food magazine, a family recipe collection. Call 800-642-1234. Let's go back to our callers. We've got Mitchell on the line in Oshkosh. Mitchell, hi.
Hello, how's it going, guys?
Good. What book do you want to point us toward, Mitchell?
The book that we at my house always go back to is America's Test Kitchen, One Cast Iron Skillet Meals.
Hmm. Oh,
that sounds really great.
An easy cleanup.
Are there favorites out of there that you like, Mitchell?
Yes. We've made a couple different lasagnas, kind of tweaking their recipe. We've made pizzas. And I actually, just last night, we had a southwestern tamale pie.
Oh, I'm drooling over here.
That sounds great, Mitchell. Thank you so much. And we talk, of course, to people from America's Test Kitchen pretty often. And you know, when they do a recipe, they have put it through its paces. They've tried every possible experimental tweak they could think
of. Yeah, and they will give you tips for if you don't have this ingredient, you can substitute this, but do not under any circumstances use that. So yeah, we love America's Test Kitchen.
Thank you so much for that, Mitchell. We'll go now to Kat in Duluth. Kat, hi.
Hi. I had one website by a young woman called Chocolate Covered Katie, and she has tons of recipes in there for simple meals that are vegan, gluten-free, vegetarian. So that's a site that I go to. And the cookbooks that I go to are Kate O'Donnell, and she's a young American woman who has studied in India for many years. She takes the health science of India, Ayurveda, explains that in very excellent and easy terms. So you can be a beginning cook and you can be beginning person to Ayurveda. And I can't recommend her books highly enough. They're excellent.
Kat, thank you so much. Those, I hadn't heard of either of those, Judith.
No, I had not. And, you know, I think it's really interesting that people other than that are mentioning lots of people we've had on America's Test Kitchen. Several of our coworkers talked about Mark Bittman. We've had him on the show. Smitten Kitchen, also a big favorite. We've had Deb Perlman on.
Jen Hadley from Wisconsin Public Television pointed us toward the Smitten Kitchen, including the homemade Oreo recipe. I think we talked to her about that.
Yeah, there are, you know, I think when you find someone who kind of has the same palate you do and explains things well, if you have a good experience, I tend to keep going back because, you know, until I'm proven wrong.
And yeah, Stephanie Elkins, classical music host, she's been on Central Time a time or two over the years, says her go-to is the Frog Commissary Cookbook. Amazing recipes. Stephanie says her copy is disgusting, encrusted with ancient spills and annotated with modifications over the years. The best homemade garlic and herb cheese spread on the planet. That sounds pretty good. That's not one I'd ever heard of either.
No, me neither.
I'm just going to check that out. Back to your calls now. Let's go to Mark with us in Onalaska. Mark, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Mark?
You know, I have tons of cookbooks, but there's some websites I use on a regular basis. Chefsteps.com is awesome, and SeriousEats.com.
Okay, that one I
know.
Those
are two really good ones.
Cool. And
he's got a cookbook out also.
What's that one called?
I think it's called Serious Eats.
Serious Eats. Oh, just like the blog. That's good marketing, actually. Do you have a favorite kind of recipe you found there, Mark?
You know, on Chef Steps, I really like the their vegetable preparations are really good. They lean a little bit towards sous vide cooking, which is getting real popular. But you know, I just figure out what I want to eat, and I look it up on one of those sites, and there's a great recipe for everything.
Fantastic. Mark and Judith, you had a little, I don't know what that gesture was, and he said sous vide cooking.
Oh, I was just laughing. That is very popular.
Yeah.
But also, I you know, vegetables, I think that's where I fall down a lot of times. I'll put more thought into kind of, you know, the main
the
thing.
Protein
and then it's like,
or whatever.
And then it's like, oh, I'm just going to roast them or steam them or whatever. But yeah, I'd like to get a little more creative with my vegetables.
Now, you say just roast them, but that's one of those techniques when I came across as like, where have you been all my
life?
You've
been roasting like, everything now.
Yeah. How much easier does it get? Cut stuff up, toss in olive oil, whatever spices you want, roast it in the oven at 400 or whatever until it's done.
Have you done sunchokes?
No, I used to eat those more. I used to eat those raw, though, like on salads.
Oh, really?
I haven't done roasted sunchokes.
Yeah, roast sunchokes. They're really good.
This is about the right time of year, isn't it?
Yeah,
or are we past them already?
Nope, they're in
Jerusalem
the store.
Jerusalem artichokes,
yes,
a.k.a.
Also, yes, yes. And it's a tuber that's related to sunflowers, I believe.
Really? Wow. You learn something new every day on this show. We are talking about favorite cookbooks, cooking websites, cooking magazines. You can still call in with yours at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I think that this cookbook that I have would be of particular interest to Judith.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to will it to her, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you.
This is a book that I bought in a Paris flea market. It was put together by the people who worked at the American Hospital of Paris.
Oh, wow.
As a fundraiser for the hospital. So on the left-hand page, a recipe is printed in French, and on the right-hand page, the same recipe is printed in English.
Interesting.
And there are no pictures in this cookbook, but there are several pencil drawings. So obviously, you don't really know what you're going to end up with, really. But I have found really interesting recipes, and they all use commonplace ingredients, so I don't have to think about going to Paris to buy the ingredients, although I would, because that's a good reason.
Wow. Oh, that sounds really interesting, Nancy. So what year might that be from?
I think it was 1978.
Wow. Yes. Okay. So interesting.
Yes. And it goes on in great detail about how this building, the American Hospital of Paris, was really built. And how it became much larger eventually than it was to begin with.
Wow, that's great. Well, thank you so much for sharing that,
that
Nancy.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, and actually it kind of relates, when Nancy started talking, it reminded me of another type of cookbook, which Jackie in Hillsborough has something to say about. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a big fan of Old Church Lady cookbooks.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I can almost always find at least a few good desserts in there. Of course, main meals that you know are staples in so many families across this area. I also like Taste of Home, which is a Wisconsin-based publication. I don't like their magazine. I prefer the books from probably 10, 20 years ago. I'm a big fan of those. I cook and bake a lot for Men on the Farm, and I have a notebook that I keep track of everything in.
Wow.
So I can write constant notes of, this dessert holds up well to go to the field. This dessert melts. Like, don't do this for this season. And I used to be afraid to write in cookbooks because I didn't want to make them dirty. And now I write everywhere because I will write what I added this time, how it actually doesn't take that long to bake, or what I did this time so I have it memory, or what people said when they ate it and date it so I can remember those things.
I think you should pass that along to someone, Jackie. That's a treasure trove there.
Or maybe we should be looking forward to your cookbook
now
that you've got all these edits and notes on them.
Absolutely. Someday I am going to compile all of them specifically for women that feed men in the field.
Well, you get those compiled and we will get you on Food,
on
Friday,
Food Friday
to talk
sure.
about it.
Thanks, Jackie, for the call at 800-642-1234. We heard from Jake Carlisle Larson, one of our producers. She likes to bake a lot. She doesn't really bring in baked goods for us that much.
There's a disconnect here.
Yeah, but whatever. But anyway, she says she's a big fan of the Great Scandinavian Baking Book by Beatrice Ojikangas, which is stained, she says, to oblivion. She also made olive oil cake with roasted strawberries, which she did bring in from Food 52's Genius Desserts. Okay, so we got to eat that one. I guess I shouldn't complain. Time for another caller or two. Let's try Rachel in Eau Claire. Rachel, hi.
Hi.
What do you got for us, Rachel?
My favorite cookbook is Deborah Madison's Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone.
Right. She had a bunch of books, right?
Yeah, she does. But this one is, you know, it's set out really well for people who either don't know how to cook or have an ingredient and don't know how to use it. So
oh,
it's
handy.
Set up with, you know, you have your basic vegetables, and so you can go through and look at the vegetables or pairs of vegetables. And one of the things she does really well is she teaches you how to cook as you go along, so you learn cooking methods. I've never had one of her recipes that wasn't pretty tasty.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Rachel. I want to get, hold on, Judith, I want to get at least one more caller in, Cece in Door County. Cece, hi.
Hi, happy Friday.
And to you, what do you want to share with us for a cooking resource, Cece?
Okay, there's a website called Supercook, and what you do is you go to their website and you type in any ingredients that you would have in your cupboard, and it will give you options for all different kinds of recipes to make. So, I mean, for a long time, I was a stay-at-home mom, and I would cook everything from scratch, and this was great because if I, you know, I tend to repeat meals, so I would just go in, type in what I had, and they would suggest a lot of things. It was fantastic.
Well, that's a nice boost to creativity, yeah. Too, Cece. Thanks so much. So any inspiration here for you, Judith, what you're going
to
check out?
Yeah, lots. Actually, I'm going to try to get some better, or I shouldn't say better, more creative ways to do vegetables. And actually, I love grilling, so I'm going to look at some interesting grilling stuff. I haven't done a lot with rubs and things like that, so I maybe try that out.
Yeah, I'm a fan of, for vegetables, you know, I mean, on skewers, obviously, yeah. You just marinate things, or the packet, you know, I'll do carrot packets, mm-hmm. or if I've got thin asparagus that I'm worried is going to fall through a grill, I'll just do asparagus packets on the grill.
In foil.
Yeah, just foil packets of that. All right, well, a lot of great inspiration. Thank you so much. You can keep it going on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Keep sharing your favorite cooking resources. Judith, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
That's Judith Sears-Poisson, executive producer of Central Time, cooking fan herself. She joined us for this week's Food Friday to talk about our favorite cookbooks, magazines, food blogs, and other resources. President Trump is taking a new approach to stemming illegal immigration at the southern border. In a series of tweets yesterday, Trump said the U.S. will impose new tariffs on all goods from Mexico. They would stay in place until Mexico stops, the president's word, the flow of illegal immigrants into the U.S. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders told reporters this morning that the move should not come as a shock.
We notified a number of members of Congress prior to the statement yesterday, but at the same time, anybody in this country or frankly in the world that says that they're surprised by this has been living under a rock and not paying attention. The president's been crystal clear that we have to take action, we have to step up, we have to do more, and we have to secure our border.
The announcement comes as Trump prepares to send Congress a new trade deal between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada for a vote this summer. Ian Colgren is a reporter on Politico's employment and immigration team. Ian, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be here.
Well, from what we've seen from the White House so far, can you give us the nuts and bolts of what the president is planning here?
Yes, indeed. You know, I will agree with Sarah Huckabee Sanders that this is not exactly a surprise. This is something that the president has floated before. Essentially, he said last night that he would impose a 5% tariff on all goods coming from Mexico until they took unspecified steps to stem the flow of illegal immigration to the United States. He said that could increase to as high as 25% if Mexico doesn't solve the problem.
Have we had any kind of deal any kind of idea of what Mexico would have to do, what kind of benchmarks the country would have to reach to have those tariffs reversed?
That is a very good question, and it's one that the White House has not answered in detail so far. I'm sure it's something that Mexican officials are wondering themselves, which is probably part of the reason that the Mexican president sent his foreign minister up to Washington today to talk to the president's administration to try to figure out what's going on and what could get them back on the same page.
Immigration has been a big story, of course, over the last bunch of years. What do we know about the latest at the U.S.-Mexico border and the number of people arriving and in many cases trying to claim asylum in the United States?
Well, there are a lot of people at the border right now. There are more people there than when the administration said a couple months ago that the system had reached its breaking point, and they're actually starting to fly people who come in the border in South Texas to other places to get processed because there are so many. Now, the increase is not necessarily unusual this time of year because spring and early summer are a time historically where numbers have picked up.
I want to give a listen to Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson and what he had to say about these tariffs. He was speaking this morning on Fox News.
Tariffs are taxes on American consumers, so I'm always concerned, but understand how President Trump is trying to use this as leverage. And Sam, the situation is completely out of control. In just the first 8 months of this fiscal year, 400,000 individuals have crossed the border illegally and been apprehended coming in as either an unaccompanied child or as a member of a family. If we continue at May's pace, it'll be 800,000 before the end of the year, fiscal year 2019.
That's one Republican saying he shares concerns about immigration, but he's not wild about the tariffs. What have we heard from his fellow Republicans in Congress?
It's actually sort of amazing how many Republicans and how have come out against this and how forcefully they've come out against this. The Chamber of Commerce today, for example, which is a very steadfast Republican ally, as you know, said that it was actually considering filing a legal challenge against the administration to stop this. Chuck Grassley, another powerful senator, said that he does not support the idea and indicated that it may derail a vote on the president's renegotiated NAFTA deal with Mexico. So this is certainly something that is not going to help Trump's standing with Republicans and surely Democrats, too, on Capitol Hill.
Talking to Ian Colgren, reporter at Politico, looking at the president's call for tariffs and increasing staged steps of tariffs on Mexican goods, all of them coming into the United States, if the country doesn't do something to stop the flow of immigrants, illegal immigrants into the United States. Ian, you mentioned that trade agreement, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, the replacement to NAFTA, agreed on by the leaders of the three countries, needs to be ratified by the legislature in all three, including, of course, Congress. Talk more about what this could do to potentially upset that deal.
Well, this could completely upset the apple cart on the deal. It's after months of negotiating over this deal, this is essentially the administration throwing in a new condition at the 11th hour that is not going to make anyone happy, least of all Mexico. So it's something that could not only harm support for the deal in Congress, but is also something that really could destroy support for it on Mexico's side, too.
And as you mentioned, at least one Republican senator has said, hey, this may make it harder to ratify in Congress. It's not even without this deal wasn't a slam dunk in Congress, right?
Right. That's correct. It was going to be a hard sell anyway, and this certainly makes it harder.
What are some of the concerns about the possible economic impact of these tariffs starting at 5%, going up to 25% on American businesses and consumers?
Right. Well, to give you a perspective, the U.S. imported $371 billion of goods from Mexico last year. And that's everything from avocados to blue jeans to washers and dryers, you name it, especially cars are a big concern, too, because a lot of the U.S. domestic car manufacturers will get parts and the like from Mexico. So this is something that could really, really raise prices on U.S. consumers, which won't be good for the president heading into an election year if this comes to pass. If the economy slows down, he could be in a situation where he is explaining to voters why the economy took a dip right as he was heading into re-election. Obviously, the president and his advisors have long supported tariffs, a blunt instrument though they are, and are betting that this will help him on the immigration issue with his base more than it will hurt the economy.
And the president has had some support. Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican, once a Trump critic, now a big ally of the president, spoke out in favor of this. So not everyone in Congress is opposed to these tariffs.
That's true. And although this is about illegal immigration for the president, from the president's perspective, you may even see some Democrats not too forcefully speaking out against this at the very least, because many on the left, also the farther left, the progressive movement, if you will, have supported the idea of reworking trade deals and being less, shall we say, free trade than the mainstream.
Now, what are you watching for next when it comes to this story and these tariffs?
Right. Well, I think we'll have to see how it festers in Congress to see if this is something that could really affect the passage of the trade deal. We'll be interested to see how congressional leadership responds. And it will also be interesting to see how this coincides with the president's other actions at the border. Chief among them, my colleagues and I broke a story yesterday about how the administration is considering new restrictions on asylum that would prevent anyone who has traveled through another country on their way to the U.S. from claiming asylum once they get to United States soil. And so that's something that should be coming down the pike and will be made public very soon. And at that point, it will be interesting to see whether this changes the calculus for any members of Congress.
We'll watch for that. And you also mentioned earlier possible legal challenges, if nothing else, from the Chamber of Commerce. Some people have raised the question about whether the president has the authority to do this particular type of tariff. Do you see that as being a likely challenge down the road?
I do see it as being a likely challenge down the road. The chamber and others who might challenge this will essentially argue that the president does not have the authority to do this without Congress. The administration has its reasoning for why it can, and it will be up to the courts and the venue where this lawsuit is chosen, especially in the lower courts, to decide which side is correct in that.
Ian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Ian Colgren, reporter on Politico's employment and immigration team. We talked to them about President Trump's plan to impose new tariffs on goods from Mexico. They would start at 5% on June 10th and increase by 5% each month, reaching 25% in October. They would remain in place until Mexico substantially cuts down on the flow of illegal immigrants into the U.S. The changing seasons have some people excited about mushrooms, in particular the wild ones you can't find in the grocery store. Some of them have exotic names like hen of the woods, black trumpet, and morel, and a greater variety of flavors and textures than we might be used to. That's in part why more and more people are venturing into the forest to forage for them. Time might be running out to snag morel mushrooms, but our next guest says foraging opportunities are just beginning for this year. Alden Dirks is a graduate student at the UW-Madison, and he's founder and president of the Madison Mycological Society. Alden, thanks a lot for coming up to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what got you into wild mushrooms?
I think many people have this entry point through eating mushrooms, and I found these really interesting mushrooms in the grocery store that were being sold, and that was my first adventuring into eating wild mushrooms. And I got hooked to the flavor and tastes and culinary possibilities, so I just had to go hunt them myself.
A lot of people are probably familiar, most likely familiar with morels. That's about where my knowledge begins and ends when it comes to wild mushrooms. How is our morel season this year locally?
It's good. You know, this is only my second season here in Wisconsin, and I've had some great hauls so far. But it's pretty unpredictable year to year. I would say we have another week or two left. But morel season, it progresses as you go north. So if you're in northern Wisconsin, you might have a few more weeks still.
And what do you like to do with morels once you have them in hand?
Recently, I just made a great pizza. Just chopped them up and got the oven nice and hot. And that makes for a delicious meal. But yeah, you can add them to. The flavors are really, they work well with fat. So butter and cheese will complement it very well.
I've gone morel hunting once. My haul was exactly zero morels. It was just the wrong time of year. You have to be ready for frustration, right, when you're going out mushroom foraging.
You do, yeah. Morels are hard. I mean, wild mushrooms in general are hard because we can't cultivate them because usually they form these symbiotic relationships with trees. So you have to find them in the wild. And sometimes we have a good sense of their ecology, but sometimes we don't. And morels are these very strange organisms, actually. And there's some general rules you can follow to try to find them. But the reality is you can sometimes find them in the most random places, and sometimes where you might expect to find them, you don't.
Before we get into some of the other mushrooms out there that we can forage for and eat, can you talk a little bit about the ecology of the mushroom and the role, the maybe unsung role it plays in nature?
Sure. So we're interacting with fungi generally all the time. They're literally all around us. Every breath we take, we're breathing in dozens of spores of fungi. So they are essential for all ecosystems as decayers, as nutrient recyclers. They form symbiotic relationships with all, pretty much 90% of plants rely on fungi. And they're also pathogens, which is really devastating for many people or farmers, but for ecosystems in general, all of those ecological interactions are important and necessary.
Yeah, the things we see as mushrooms, they're just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the fungus world, right?
Exactly. And one kind of comparison people have used is like an apple and a tree. It doesn't quite work the exact same, but it really is only a part of the larger fungus, which we call the mycelium, which for the most part is invisible, but is radiating through soil and through wood and pretty much everything around us.
All right, the morel is the celebrity of the wild mushroom world, at least here in Wisconsin. Maybe it's different elsewhere. I don't know. What are some of the other kinds of wild mushroom that we might find over the course of a summer?
Yeah, so mushroom seasons, the edible mushrooms really go on from May, beginning of middle of May, until end of October, November even. And even though morel season is coming to an end, soon enough there will be chanterelles, which are also a favorite of mine and lots of people's. Black trumpets, and then we have hen of the woods and chicken of the woods, oyster mushrooms, porcini. The list goes on and on, really.
And my worry would be, if I went out by myself, I'm really bad at telling one type of wildlife from another. Birds, plants, mushrooms, presumably, you name it. I'd be worried that I'd find an inedible one and think it was edible. How can we make sure we're safe out mushroom harvesting?
Yeah, for me, the best way to learn how to forage wild mushrooms is to go out with other people. And that's why I was excited to start the Madison Mycological Society, to bring together people who are experienced and who have less experience to learn together. And I really think of it as a K-12 one-room classroom, where you have people who are very experienced, who have a lot of knowledge and can share that. But you also have people who are fresh to it. And they come with new and fresh eyes and observations and excitement. And I think that combination makes for a great experience.
We're talking about foraging for wild mushrooms. Alden Dirks is with us, founder and president of the Madison Mycological Society. Now, you mentioned you're relatively new to Wisconsin. You're from Boston previously, or that area?
Grew up in Pennsylvania, but moved from Boston prior.
Is there a different mushroom scene over there when you were out foraging compared to Wisconsin?
A little bit, but for the most part, you could generalize between northeastern North America. You have a pretty similar ecology compared to western North America or southern North America. So really, the Rockies are a divider of North America, and you have very different species. Those mountains, they are actually a geological divide that don't allow many things to cross over. So you have very distinct species on each side of the mountains.
So have you been mushroom foraging west of the Rockies ever?
Not quite. I just traveled, but I will be in 2 weeks. I'll be going out to Oregon, and hopefully you have big burn sites out there, and you have, even though morel season coming to an end here out west, you can find them growing in these burn sites where thousands of acres of wildfires lead to these massive flushes of morels. So I'm very excited. And those are even different species of morels. We have at least 6 different species of morels in Wisconsin even. So across North America, there's about 30 different species. So depending on where you are, you even have a whole different selection of morel species, for example.
6 different morel species in Wisconsin. I didn't know that. Would I taste the difference?
It's a good question. I'm not experienced enough with all of them. But some of them you can't really tell apart very well. Morphologically, you have to use DNA to sequence the specimen, or you have to use microscopy. But a few of them, really there's 3 distinct ones. And most of us are most familiar with a species called Morchella americana, which is the common gray or blonde morel. It's the same species. But we also have the half-free morel and burn morel. So I'm not experienced enough with the other 2 species to know if they taste different, actually.
And you are a grad student. Is this part of your research as well? It's not just your hobby?
This is not. Well, okay. It's career, it's life, hobby, it's everything. But my research is very different. I actually work for my research on fungi that do not produce macroscopic or visible mushrooms.
So spore only?
Not just, you have the cells called the mycelium, and it does not produce macroscopic mushrooms. It does produce spores, right? But these are not in these kinds of like structures that are used to spread the spores. And these are called mycorrhizal fungi that associate with plants and are very important for the health of most agricultural crops. So that's what I work on for my graduate research.
Interesting. So we brought you up to talk about the edible ones, but now I'm really curious. Like, what are some facts about the fungus world that a lot of us might not be aware of. You've already shared a couple of them with us.
Yeah, so we were talking about these choice edibles like morels, but there's all different types of choice inedible fungi, I like to call them. And they are really essential for all these ecosystem functionings. And when we go out, just a fraction of the mushrooms are edible. The vast majority are inedible and some are poisonous. So we can talk about the macroscopic fungi, which maybe constitute just a small portion, and there is a large portion that we can't even see. So you have this whole range, and they're just doing many different things in the environment.
How do you go out and collect the microscopic fungi? Obviously, the definition is you can't really see them out in the wild.
Right. So these happen. I collect these by taking soil cores, and then I use next generation sequencing technologies to, I don't even look at the species. I've never even seen them. What I do is I pull them out with these sequencing technologies, and through these technologies, I can see the thousands of different species that exist in the soil.
Wow. So just like one sample, you might find maybe 100 different DNA samples of different kinds of fungus?
Right. So there's about 100,000 described species of fungi, but an estimated 10 million out there. And many of those are these microscopic fungi. So if you take just a very small bit of soil, it really does have thousands and thousands of species in it. And many of those are unknown to science.
So it might be very plausible for you in your career to discover multiple species of fungus.
I hope so.
Which seems cool.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm working on that right now, actually, a few more obscure species. So, yeah, I get the Madison Mycological Society and my own relationship with mycology comes about through this concept called biocultural restoration, which comes from Dr. Robin Kimmerer, who is from Wisconsin. And for me, it's this connection that I have to nature. It's this science and practice of developing a relationship to place. So people have all sorts of connections to place through hunting, through fishing, through bird watching. But for me, that's really mushrooms, both the edible and non-edible ones, because there are so many species out there, and they're so aesthetically interesting and wild.
All right. I've just a short time. People talk about terroir. I'm pronouncing the French word wrong. The idea that the soil a thing comes from influences the taste. Could these fungus that we don't even see be part of that?
Yes, absolutely. There's truffles, for example, which the white truffle is the most expensive food item in the world, is known to associate with many different bacteria. And it's thought that these bacteria that associate with these truffles do contribute a lot to the flavor. And it's the same with morels, for example. People have tried cultivating morels, but the cultivated versions just don't taste as good as the wild ones.
So is there a mushroom, getting back to the edibles, just in our last few moments, that you're looking forward to as the year goes on, now that morels are winding down?
Yes, I'm very excited. I'm particularly fond of chicken of the woods, and you get these large orange fruiting mushrooms that appear, and those ones are very delicious. I'm looking forward to those.
Fantastic. Alden, thanks so much for coming up and sharing this with us today.
Thank you, and I hope everyone can look at the Madison Mycological Society and join us for forays.
That's Alden Dirks, founder and president of the Madison Mycological Society. We talked with him about foraging for wild mushrooms right now and into summer, and about the ecology of fungus, big and small. If you forage yourself, we would love to hear from you, maybe even a picture of some of your best hauls. You can send that to us, email ideas@WPR.org, or as always, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Share some of your favorite mushroom finds over the years. Yesterday on the show, we talked about a new trout management plan developed by the state DNR. And afterwards, I realized I left a key question unanswered. What do you call a group of trout? At first, I think it would be a school, right? Like a school of fish. But according to some internet research, we can get more specific. A group of trout is apparently called a hover of trout. Hover, like you're hovering over something. Where does that come from? I don't know. So I'll do some more research and get back to you on that. But then, you know, once I was on the website to find out what groups of animals are called, I found some more of interest here in Wisconsin. A group of badgers is called a seet, C-E-T-E, pronounced apparently seet. That was news to me. Cows, of course, they're a herd. You knew that. So are deer. Of particular interest to Central Time listeners, a group of ferrets is called a business. I should have known that. I didn't. So every time I get together for a family gathering, it's a business. Our producer, Bill Martins, should know a group of martins is a richness. And a group of seagulls, I looked this up, should be obvious to any child of the 80s. Nope, you're wrong. It's a colony, but there are some alternative names out there. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.